A major realignment in the Middle East as the Assad government in Syria falls to Islamist rebels. What could this mean for Christian minorities in the region? Catholic experts with deep knowledge of Syria and the potential religious implications join us to discuss. The power of forgiveness in the face of unbearable grief. We speak to a mother who lost her child in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting 12 years ago this weekend. How her Catholic faith has pulled her through. The rebirth of Notre Dame, a glorious scene in Paris, as one of the world's most beloved Catholic cathedrals reopens for worship. And providing a safe space for those who need to worship differently. We visit a sensory mass to see how it's bringing those with special needs back to church. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Every minute is about a week long right now as we wait for him to walk free.
An American mother waits for the return of her son, jailed for years in a Syrian prison. The Austin Tice family hopeful for a positive resolution to their son's case following the dramatic fall of the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria. It took only 10 days for the Assad dynasty to crumble. After 50 years of ironclad rule, the brutal regime, which took hundreds of thousands of lives and forced millions to flee Syria, fell as Islamist rebel forces advanced. Bashar al-Assad fled the country to exile in Russia. The fate of Syria changes the balance of power in the Middle East and has ramifications for the Christian communities who remain. Reporter Mark Irons sets the scene.
What happens next in Syria now that the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad has crumbled? First, there were signs of elation in Damascus earlier this week after rebels captured the capital. They entered the city with ease as Assad fled to Russia, where he received asylum. The rebel group that took control, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, is classified as a terrorist organization by the U.S. The group branched off from al-Qaeda years ago and promises not extremism, but a more moderate form of leadership. For now, it's unclear what a future Syrian government might look like or who would ultimately lead. On Sunday, President Joe Biden shared the significance and uncertainty of the moment.
It's a moment of historic opportunity for the long-suffering people of Syria to build a better future for their proud country. It's also a moment of risk and uncertainty.
President-elect Donald Trump sharing his thoughts on social media, saying, "Syria is a mess, but is not our friend, and the United States should have nothing to do with it. This is not our fight. Let it play out. Do not get involved." But along with the U.S., a number of countries do have an interest in what happens next, including Israel, Iran, Turkey, and Russia. Following Assad's ouster, America carried out airstrikes hitting ISIS targets in the central part of Syria. Lloyd Austin, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, explained why he thinks it's important to continue deterring what's left of the terrorist organization following the fall of Assad's regime.
Elements in the area, such as ISIS, could try to take advantage of this opportunity and regain capability.
About 900 U.S. troops have remained in Syria following the defeat of ISIS in 2019. Meanwhile, this week, Israel carried out hundreds of its own airstrikes on former Assad regime military and suspected chemical weapons sites. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel doesn't want the weapons to get in the hands of any extremist who could pose a threat.
We will not allow any hostile force to establish itself on our border.
Despite Netanyahu's reasoning for the airstrikes and Israeli claims of only operating in a disputed buffer zone territory on the border with Syria, the United Nations Special Envoy to Syria expressed concern with Israel's actions.
Israeli movements and bombardments into Syrian territory. This needs to stop.
Moving forward, what will life look like for those living in Syria and the many Syrian refugees who may return after they fled their country during Assad's reign? The rebels who easily advanced into Damascus claim they will respect the rights of all people, including women and religious minorities. U.S. officials say they will monitor HTS to see if the group stands by its claims.
We're going to judge HTS by its actions, as we will judge every group inside Syria by their actions. And one of the foremost things that we want to see protected in Syria are the rights of religious and ethnic minorities.
I think everyone is waiting to see how they will treat these communities.
Nadine Menza, the president of the International Religious Freedom Secretariat, is concerned about religious minorities, including Christians, in the region. In the northern part of Syria, along the border with Turkey, an area controlled by the U.S.-backed Kurds, she says religious minorities face threats from Turkish-backed forces.
This environment has created a dangerous situation for some religious minorities, especially now as we're seeing Turkey bomb the northeast to back these these Islamist militias that are going into the northeast and really tend to target the religious minorities there.
Quanto sta avvenendo in Siria in questo momento.
From the Vatican, during his Wednesday audience, Pope Francis called for peace and unity in Syria. On X, he said, "I pray that the Syrian people may live in peace. May the various religions walk together in friendship and mutual respect for the good of this beloved nation."
As you see now in Syria, what's going to happen?
At the Vatican, Cardinal Claudio Gujarati is prefect of the Dicastery for the Eastern Churches. He worries about many of the Eastern Catholic churches with ancient roots throughout the Middle East and minority Christian communities today, including in Aleppo, the first major city in Syria that rebel forces captured before marching toward Damascus.
In Aleppo, we have six Oriental Catholic bishops. Six. It means that a presence of the church there, of our church, is extremely significant. And what's going to happen now?
Besides Christians, it's a question Syrians of all backgrounds might ask as they reflect on the past. Under the Assad dictatorship, dissenters were dealt with harshly, imprisoned and tortured. Hundreds of thousands were killed, and the regime faced international blame for using chemical weapons. Earlier this week, outside Damascus, video showed people flooding a notorious prison once used by the regime. They hoped to find loved ones, many of whom went missing years ago. Another video shows a man who identifies himself as Travis Timmerman, an American who says he entered Syria on a Christian pilgrimage but was held a prisoner for months. The U.S. Secretary of State says they're working to bring him home, and they're working to find Austin Tice, a journalist who went missing in Syria years ago. Mark and Deborah Tice, who have shared the importance of their own Catholic faith, hope they will soon reunite with their son, Austin.
We're asking anyone who has the ability or comes in contact with Austin to help bring him back home to us safely.
In 2012, while reporting on the civil war in Syria, Tice went missing. This week, President Biden expressed hope to bring him back home. Mark and Deborah have said a significant source has assured them Austin is alive and well. They say their son is resilient.
Austin also has that deep faith, and so he knows that his time will come and he will walk free.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
We are joined now by two guests with deep insights into the situation in Syria and the broader implications for the Middle East. Bishop Francois Beyrouti is the leader of the Melkite Greek Catholic Church in the United States, an Eastern Rite that's in full communion with Rome and it is headquartered in Damascus, Syria. Born in Lebanon, Bishop Francois Beyrouti has been leading the more than 20,000 Melkites in the U.S. since 2022. Alberto Fernandez is a former U.S. ambassador who has served in multiple senior diplomacy positions, including having served in Syria at the U.S. Embassy in Damascus. He's currently the vice president of the Middle East Media Research Institute, and we're also grateful to have him as a contributor to EWTN News. Thank you both for being with us. Your Excellency, I want to start with you. What are you hearing from Christians and Melkite church leaders on the ground in Syria?
There are a variety of things that I'm hearing. I've called a couple people there, bishops and other priests, and it's always a cautious balance. There's always hope, but also, as I said, a caution to match that hope with actual work of collaboration on the ground. Yeah. So the good news is that the Christian, Muslim, and other leaders are gathering to transition to this new phase in Syria. And so far, what we see is something very positive. We hope also that this initial air of positivity will continue as all the religious communities work together and also assist in helping the people flourish, because that has been a problem recently, that people have had a problem with food and safety and all sorts of other social factors. So the religious role is always to focus on the human dignity of the person, the freedom of the churches to worship, and also, and very importantly, throughout the Middle East, the role of the church in social institutions of building up churches, high schools, elementary schools, colleges, universities, and a variety of other social programs that are out there. So the initial thing that we are hearing is that this collaboration has been taking place.
That's good insight to hear. Alberto, you wrote a commentary for the National Catholic Register called "For Christians and for Everyone Else, An Uncharted Future in Syria." So for context, Alberto, how large is the Christian community in Syria right now, and how does that compare to recent years?
Thank you. I'm very honored to be on with Saadat al-Mutran. You know, we lack precise details, but we do know that the Syrian population has been in deep decline over the last 13 years since the civil war started. Some estimates say that about 80, even 90% of the population, Christian population, has left. So from that means from like a height of about 1.5 million to perhaps 200,000 or 300,000 today in the entire country. Mm-hmm. So it's still, I mean, there are still Christians there, obviously, in some numbers, but a sharp decline from what it was in the past.
Mm. Your Excellency, can you speak to the significance of Syria, specifically Damascus, as it pertains to the Christian faith? There's real historical and religious significance here.
It's definitely on a general level. Damascus is considered the largest inhabited capital, longest inhabited capital in the world. So just on that front, it's an important city. Secondly, for our great saints Peter and Paul, all had a very important journey in Damascus and also through Damascus. As we know, Saint Paul was baptized in Damascus, and prior to that, on the road to Damascus, he was struck down, blinded, and then told to go be baptized in Straight Street by Ananias, and that location still exists today. Mm. And that is an important thing to keep in mind for all Christians around the world, Catholics, Orthodox, Protestants, is that the seed of Christianity started in that part of the world, not only Jerusalem, Nazareth, but also in southern Lebanon, and all the various important cities throughout Damascus. So from that earliest time, Damascus has been a central city in what is known as the Levant Middle Eastern region. For us as Melkite Catholics, who are the Byzantine Catholic Church of Antioch, it also holds a very important significance because that is the seat or the see of our patriarchate. Of course, we are the Patriarchate of Antioch, going back to Acts 11, where the Christians were where the followers of Jesus were first time called Christians. Antioch became an important city in Eastern Christianity. But then with the fall of Antioch in the 13th century, 1268 to be exact, then the Patriarchate of Antioch, the Melkite Patriarchate of Antioch, ended up moving to Damascus. So not only did it have ancient importance prior to the 13th century, it also had an importance for the See of Antioch following that. In addition to that, we also have to keep in mind the importance of the many saints in Antioch and Syria and the Levant, including, of course, St. John of Damascus, who coined one of the most popular phrases defending the icons, that we don't worship icons, we worship him who became, we don't worship material matter, we worship him who became matter for our salvation. So all those early things that we take for granted were established in the Levant region.
Really important reminders. Thank you for that. Alberto, Assad portrayed himself and was portrayed by some others as well as the defender of Christians, almost as this firewall against ISIS and jihadism. But you write the reality is more complicated. What was Assad's relationship with Christians in Syria?
Well, you know, the dictator, of course, has, you know, people under him that he uses and manipulates as he sees fit. Assad was heavily influenced by his allies in Algeria, the so-called Eradicateurs, who practiced a policy which he adopted, which was to radicalize the revolution and then to serve as the bulwark of the revolution that he was facing. So Assad let out the worst jihadists from Syrian prisons, and people who are peaceful, people who are just opposed to the regime, those people he kept in prison, thereby radicalizing what began as a peaceful revolt. So he oppressed everyone, he robbed everyone, he played one group against another, and at the end of the day, no one was willing to die for him and fight for him. Not Muslims, not Christians, not even his own Alawite religious minority. Mm-hmm.
Your Excellency, Cardinal Mario Zanari, the Apostolic Nuncio in Syria, told Vatican News last Sunday that the rebels in Syria met with the bishops in Aleppo right away and assured them they would respect Christians. How much weight do you put into those comments reportedly made by the rebels?
It's also what I heard, that the rebels and all the various communities have met together. And that, as I said earlier, is a good sign for the future. And we hope that these initial efforts at working together will also be reinforced. Mm-hmm. And it's also important to realize that the Western powers, who are also part of this transition, also keep in mind the importance of the minorities in Syria. And I would say, especially and particularly, the Christian presence that has been deteriorated significantly. Mm.
Alberto, we are in the midst of a presidential transition here in the United States. What action would you like to see from the incoming Trump-Vance administration as it pertains to Syria?
Well, I think the incoming administration will be careful and cautious about Syria, and they should be. You know, the winners in this war have a complicated, let's put it diplomatically, complicated track record. So they need to be careful. We certainly don't want to get involved in another quagmire, as the United States has had in other places, and the new administration rightfully wants to avoid. But I think there are a couple things that we can do. First, I think, as His Excellency the Bishop said, there is humanity and solidarity with those suffering in Syria. Mm-hmm. Absolutely with the Christians of Syria, but I would say more generally with the poor. Syria is destroyed today. The Assad regime robbed it and demolished it. There are hungry people in Syria. And so we have our own interests and we have our own needs, but I think finding some way, some tangible way to showing solidarity with the Syrian people and with the pluralism, which is so important in Syria, is a good place to start.
Mm. Your Excellency, we have under 1 minute left, but I want to ask you this. You were born in Lebanon and raised in Canada. Do you have any insight you can share with us about how Christians in Lebanon are doing right now with the apparent collapse of Hezbollah and the consequences of what's happening in Syria?
The current situation, especially in the south, is very difficult because Israel bombed many of the villages, and including churches in the south, as you see on your screen. So this is an opportunity to rebuild and work together for the future. Unfortunately, this is something we have seen over and over again. I am just a little over 50 years old, and this has been repeating since the day I was born. Mm-hmm. However, not only in Lebanon, but throughout the entire Middle East, the Christians are always a sign of hope, a sign of unity, and a sign of goodwill to work with everyone, to rebuild, to collaborate, and to make sure we always focus on the human dignity and rebuilding communities, but also rebuilding human lives.
Mm, well said. Well, we thank you both for your great insights during this developing story. Thank you so much. We're just getting started. There is much more ahead today on EWTN News In Depth.
inside Notre Dame Cathedral. Some special insights from those rejoicing over the restoration and reopening of this magnificent church. Pain, resentment, and forgiveness. On the anniversary of the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, we remember one of the students who died, 6-year-old Catherine Hubbard, when her mother, Jennifer, joins us in studio to discuss how her faith has sustained her.
We're making efforts to provide a setting for Mass that they feel very comfortable in.
And later, recognizing some who want to worship but who find a regular church service overstimulating. What one parish is doing to provide a sensory Mass to those with special needs. We'll be right back. Bishop of Paris knocks three times on the grand wooden door of Notre Dame, officially marking the reopening of the Gothic masterpiece. It is the first time since the devastating fire in 2019 that the Catholic cathedral welcomed the faithful back to worship. The rebirth of Notre Dame was celebrated by song, prayer, and awe beneath its soaring arches. 5 years after the historic landmark closed, the cathedral opened with pomp and circumstance last Saturday evening, followed by Mass and consecration of the new altar Sunday morning. Behind the hundreds of millions of dollars it took to restore was the determination of the many who labored to return Notre Dame to its glory. Here is EWTN News In-Depth correspondent Colin Flynn in Paris.
When the fire tore through the Cathedral of Notre Dame in 2019, many people feared that France and the world had just lost one of its great treasures. But incredibly, 5 years on, the cathedral has been reborn and restored to its former glory. Well, I've come to Paris to find out what the restoration of Notre Dame means to the people of France. When TV cameras started to show the live pictures, many found them hard to believe. One of the jewels in the crown of Paris, a structure dating back to the 12th century, one of the world's great cathedrals, was burning and looked like it was going to crumble. Thanks to the heroic efforts of the firefighters, its main structure and priceless artifacts were saved, but the damage was devastating. The images of the burning cathedral affected so many people that it caused an outpouring of support and solidarity. And people around the world rallied together and pledged almost $800 million to restore the cathedral. And the man with the enormous task of carrying out the project was chief architect Philippe Villeneuve.
Several times I came to the United States to speak about this chantier.
I've heard you say before that the day the fire started here at Notre Dame, the little boy inside of you died. What did you mean by that?
Well, because I've been madly in love with Notre Dame de Paris since I was little. Growing up, it was inside the cathedral where I felt good. And when I was 16, I made a model of the cathedral. I was really captivated by it, moved by it. And little did I know as a kid when I was building the cathedral out of card and paper that one day I would be working on the real cathedral. And so when I laid the last stone of the vault in the north transept, it brought me back. And I saw myself as a kid again, building this vault with paper and cardboard.
With pressure from the French government and the 340,000 private donors from around the world, Philippe Villeneuve had to make sure that, as much as possible, original techniques and materials were used, and a team of over 2,000 people worked on the restoration for 5 years.
It
was an enormous amount of work. I realize it now, looking at where we came from.
Je suis stupéfait de la beauté
I'm really amazed by the beauty, amazed by the work, by the quality of work.
The deeper meaning behind this, are you a man of faith?
J'ai passé 5 ans à rien dire à ce sujet-là.
You know, I spent 5 years saying nothing about this, because I'm a civil servant in a secular republic, and therefore I couldn't say something like this. But now, I have to reveal that, yes,
que j'ai une dévotion particulière à la Vierge, Marie.
I have a particular devotion to the Virgin Mary, and at the risk of sounding totally crazy, or like Joan of Arc, I never stopped feeling support coming from up there. I don't think this project would have been possible otherwise, and I think that's what gave me the strength and determination to move forward, because I knew I was supported from up there.
In the week leading up to the official reopening, the completed restoration work was officially inspected by Emmanuel Macron. The French president, along with millions of others watching live on television, was given a first look at the new altar, the white stone and gold details, and the restored bells. And guiding the president through the cathedral was the rector of Notre Dame, Father Olivier Riboudouma.
At a time when religion, organized religion, is declining in the West, and cultures and countries are becoming more secular, were you surprised at the outcry and the outpouring of sorrow and grief when the fire struck in 2019, and the will and the want to restore it from everybody?
When the cathedral burned on April 15th, 2019, the strong emotional reaction clearly demonstrated everyone's attachment to this Notre-Dame de Paris cathedral. Because this cathedral is something of the soul of France, the history of our country is intimately linked with the history of the cathedral, and at the same time, its influence extends far beyond France. The cathedral does not belong to Parisians, nor to Catholics, nor to the French, but it is the common good of all humanity. And its stones speak of God because they have been animated by prayer for more than 800 years.
In the build-up to the reopening, a row erupted in France after the Minister for Culture suggested a 5 euro fee should be charged to visitors, which could be put towards restoring some of the country's other crumbling cathedrals. However, the Catholic Church and the rector of Notre Dame strongly opposed this, saying entrance to a church should always be free, as it's a place of worship and not a museum.
I have to make sure it is a place of prayer, so that it is a place of celebration, and so that it is a place of discovery of faith.
As the Christmas lights twinkle up and down the Champs-Élysées, and the Eiffel Tower shines its light across the city, last-minute preparations are underway at the cathedral the night before the grand opening. And in a nearby church, a choir of men and women are holding a final rehearsal. This is the Notre Dame Workers' Choir, made up of over 80 architects, engineers, carpenters, crane operators, construction workers.
Painter, wow. And most of the time I'm a sculptor.
Many of us are not familiar with singing or involving any choir, so I think the result is convincing.
It's okay. It's okay.
I think it will be magic.
I'm a Muslim, and for me, being in this choir is all about practicing tolerance on a human scale. It is a fabulous moment for me.
Under the direction of Frédéric Pinou, they are preparing to perform inside Notre Dame in just a few days, the very cathedral which they helped to bring back to life.
We're going to turn now to Paris, where world leaders are gathering to celebrate the reopening of the Notre Dame Cathedral.
After 5 long years of working and waiting, on a cold and misty Saturday night, December the 7th, as the nation watched live on television, the Archbishop of Paris, Laurent Ulrich, knocked on the doors of Notre Dame.
Model de la foi.
Amen.
Inside, the sound of Notre Dame's famous 8,000 pipe organ filled the cathedral, and a choir sung out in joy. The cathedral looking brighter than ever, as all the stone had been cleaned, every single structure repainted, and the stained glass windows given back their colour and vibrancy. In attendance were representatives of over 50 nations, including Prince William from the United Kingdom, First Lady Jill Biden from the United States, Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, and US President-elect Donald Trump, who stood right next to French President Emmanuel Macron. Notably absent was Pope Francis, who chose to decline the invitation.
Vive Notre-Dame de Paris.
And the following morning, another joyous occasion, when on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, the first Mass was celebrated inside the cathedral and the altar consecrated. In attendance was Henri Delsem, who was greeted by President Macron because of his bravery. Nicknamed France's backpack hero for saving children during a terrorist attack in 2023, he told me he believes Notre Dame's rebirth will be a sign to the young people of France.
There is a lot of energy in France, and people are looking for something to dream about.
Something to believe in.
Something to, yes, to believe in, but to dream about. Look at the spire of the cathedrals. Yes. It is a direction.
When you say that the spire is a signpost to direct people to dream about something, what is it pointing people towards?
It's like a bridge between earth and heaven.
Earth and heaven.
A finger showing God. Even if we don't have faith, it is a direction, okay? It is a symbol of an ideal, like always look up to the sky, dream big, and to act with greatness.
And with that, the doors of the stunning Notre Dame Cathedral have reopened, ready to welcome once again pilgrims and worshippers from all over the world. In Paris, France, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
Stunning. Throughout this first week of celebration, there were morning masses every day open only by invitation, and daily vespers and evening mass open to the general public. Starting next week, the cathedral will be open for regular hours with visitation time slots available to welcome between 25,000 to 30,000 visitors a day. And Sunday recitals on the massive restored organ will resume free to the public every Sunday at 4 p.m. Welcome back, Notre Dame, Our Lady of Paris. The Vatican had an unveiling of its own this week as it opened its annual exhibit of nativity scenes. More than 130 diverse nativity scenes from 21 countries are on display. Some are more complex recreations of Christ's humble birthplace. Others are reminiscent of the country they are from, like Brazil's. The display also included some less than traditional presentations, like a nativity scene on a boat, a Holy Family plunged underwater, or a tiny crèche within a mobile phone. EWTN News in Depth will be right back.
There's no words that I could come up with that would even come close to describing the sheer terror of hearing that your son is in a place, or your child is in a place, where there's been violence.
It was 12 years ago this Saturday that elementary school parents in Newtown, Connecticut, frantically sought to reunite with their children after reports of a shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School began to surface. For many families that day, their lives were forever changed. On December 14, 2012, a gunman with a semi-automatic rifle killed 20 first graders and six educators at Sandy Hook before taking his own life. 12 years later, the shooting at Sandy Hook remains the deadliest at an elementary school in U.S. history. One of the victims that day was 6-year-old Catherine Violet Hubbard. The first grader was known to be a passionate animal lover, so in her honor, her mother, Jennifer Hubbard, established the Catherine Violet Hubbard Foundation to promote healing through human-animal connection. Jennifer has become a national Catholic speaker and retreat leader who shares how she grappled with God amid her daughter's death. And on this 12-year anniversary of the Sandy Hook shooting, we are joined in studio now by Jennifer Hubbard. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us here and being with us on this day.
Thank you.
Here we are, marking the 12-year anniversary of the Sandy Hook shooting. How are you doing? And what are these anniversaries like now, 12 years later?
Thank you for asking. This year, I'm remarkably peaceful. You know, every single year, I find myself in this different place. And I think it has a lot to do with just where I am on my own personal journey. And some years are really hard. They bring up a lot of emotions. The week leading up to the anniversary, I literally live in two time zones. I can tell you exactly what I was doing 12 years ago on this day at this time, right up to when I found out that Catherine was gone. And it just, different memories, different emotions, they seem to surface. This year, I'm so peaceful. Yeah.
Wow. And not to ever, you know, judge if you feel different year by year.
Yeah.
Like that's the complication of grief.
Yeah.
Probably.
I've learned that grief is such this unique friend, if you will, that when you learn to lean into it and live with it and not try to push it away, suffering is a part of our life. It's a promise. It's a biblical promise that we're going to have suffering. But I think that when you have a deep-rooted faith and trust, you move through it and you recognize what healing comes from that moment.
Jennifer, I understand you are a cradle Catholic. You have been Catholic your whole life. But 12 years ago, when news broke of this tragic shooting and you got the worst news that a parent could get, did you turn to God in that moment during that time? And did you feel any consolation from God?
I did.
Really?
I did. My faith was not where it is today by any stretch. I remember driving to the firehouse. I got a phone call saying, you know, come on down, something's happened. And it was early in the morning. And I remember driving down to the firehouse and saying, oh God, help me. And I didn't realize in that moment, like, that I was praying. Like, at that point in my life, prayer for me was this very regimented process. But that just not that nod to God, like, help me, help me. He did.
Just turning to Him and giving Him what you have. And when you reflect on your faith journey these past 12 years, you say that you're in a different place today than you were then. Do you feel more closely connected with God? Can you describe that journey?
Okay, I do. For me, when Catherine died, I would go to Mass. I would practice my faith. Prayer was this little moment of my morning. I had a friend that was, she was encouraging me to do a Bible study and do a devotional. And it was, so it was like these little tidbits.
Compartmentalized.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Yep. So I would put my kids on the bus and I'd come back home and I would sit for a few minutes, read scripture, read a devotional. And then after Catherine died, those few minutes became just moments of just sitting in stillness. I think what I'm realized is the habits that we have in our lives, they're going to form our habits when the unthinkable strikes. And so I love the fact that I had the routine of sitting at the kitchen table and praying and reading and diving into my faith, because those 5 minutes became 50 minutes. There were some days where I'd sit there for hours. And what I discovered was that the faraway God that I had started this journey with was not far away at all. It was right there.
Yeah, He was holding you.
Yeah.
Can you talk about, was there any temptation to hold on to resentment amid this journey? I mean, how do you fight that? And have you been able to find forgiveness?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, there's resentment. Mm. And I think that there's bitterness. And I think that there's a wanting and a disappointment of this is not how life was supposed to be. And I think that sometimes there's the tendency, if I'm a strong Catholic, if I am strong in my faith and I do what I'm supposed to do, then trials aren't going to come to me. And so when they do, I think sometimes the tendency is to think, well, why did this happen? Like, I didn't deserve this. And we kind of hold it in our hearts. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the resentment comes in. And I think that what I've learned is that forgiveness is being transparent with that, not shying away from it, not being scared of it, but offering it up to God and to be able to say that this is the emotions that are bringing up with me. Because forgiveness is, by definition, the intentional release of anger and resentment. And so when we know that we have a loving God, a loving Father, mm-hmm. to give that to, mm-hmm. then forgiveness comes in subtle forms. And so you come to a place where you're not holding someone else accountable for these feelings that these trials bring up. Mm. I don't hold Adam Lanza accountable. Mm. If that means that I forgive him, yeah.
That's a really honest answer. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. And Jennifer, in our final moments here together, I'd love to just give you a chance to talk about your daughter, Catherine, and the work that you're doing now with the Catherine Violet Hubbard Animal Sanctuary.
Yep. So the sanctuary we started in her memory, it was a typographical error in her obituary. Yep. I thought donations were going to the Animal Control Center. I omitted inadvertently the word control. I truly believe that in that moment I gave over control. The sanctuary is a place of healing and compassion. We believe that animals should live free from harm in homes and habitats, because that's what Catherine was, an animal girl. And so that's what she would want. What we're finding is that when we honor creation and we honor creatures, when we honor God's earth, people become kinder and gentler. Just recently, our programming, we educate, we provide direct care to animals, and we do a lot of habitat restoration. We were most recently recognized as a beacon for building human empathy.
Wow. Mm-hmm. What a beautiful response to suffering. Jennifer, thank you for your honesty, for your vulnerability. Thank you for being here.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And if you want to hear more of Jennifer's faith journey and testimony, she was featured in two episodes of EWTN's I Forgive with Immaculée Ilagabiza. You can watch it anytime on EWTN On Demand. Just go to ondemand.ewtn.com. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Developments in the shocking assassination of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York City top the Week in Review. Law enforcement officers continue to piece together evidence trying to figure out what motivated the shooter to commit such a brazen attack. Thompson was gunned down on a Manhattan street last week as he walked from his hotel to a UnitedHealthcare shareholder meeting. After days on the run and an intense manhunt, 26-year-old Luigi Mangione was arrested when he was spotted at a McDonald's in Altoona, Pennsylvania. The suspect was found with a ghost gun, false ID cards, and a handwritten manifesto that reportedly blamed the healthcare industry for corruption and power gains. Some who know him say Mangione had suffered a serious and debilitating back injury, but so far, investigators have not been able to link his personal medical situation with UnitedHealthcare. Since Thompson's murder, there have been some support for the shooter on social media by those who also find fault with the healthcare industry. After Mangione's arrest in Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth's governor batted down those sentiments.
In America, we do not kill people in cold blood to resolve policy differences or express a viewpoint. But I have no tolerance, nor should anyone, for one man using an illegal ghost gun to murder someone because he thinks his opinion matters most. In a civil society, We are all less safe when ideologues engage in vigilante justice.
Mangione is charged with murder in Manhattan, along with gun and forgery charges in Pennsylvania. He grew up in Maryland in privileged circumstances, graduating as valedictorian from the Gilman School, a private boys prep school in Baltimore, and went on to an Ivy League education at the University of Pennsylvania. He comes from a prominent Catholic family, well known in Baltimore as major benefactors, who for decades have given millions of dollars to Catholic institutions and parishes around the city. Law enforcement officials say he was in contact with his family until about 6 months ago, when he stopped communicating with them. His mother filed a missing person report a month ago. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing a very large legal challenge on top of leading his country on multiple war fronts. This week, he became the first sitting Israeli leader to take the stand as a criminal defendant in a long-running trial accusing him of corruption. The prime minister is a divisive figure in his own country. Hundreds of people, both for and against him, came to protest as the testimony began. During the trial, Netanyahu will answer to charges of fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes in three separate cases. The proceedings are being held in Tel Aviv in a secure underground courtroom. Despite his other responsibilities leading a nation with active military engagements on several fronts, testimony will take place 6 hours a day, 3 days a week, for several weeks.
The most interesting part will be in 1 month from now, when it will be a cross-examination of the prosecutions of Mr. Netanyahu. And this will be the most interesting part, that Netanyahu needs to give an answer to a very tough questions.
Netanyahu denies all wrongdoing, calling the charges against him a witch hunt orchestrated by a hostile media and biased legal system out to topple him. The testimony caps years of scandals that have swirled around him, accusing Netanyahu of enjoying a lavish lifestyle at taxpayer expense. The United Nations says Israel's continued siege in northern Gaza is preventing aid deliveries, calling it an utterly devastating situation for Palestinians. Aid has been blocked for more than 2 months, leaving tens of thousands without food, water, and health care. UN officials also point to a breakdown in law and order and looting that have further limited aid efforts in Gaza. On Wednesday, the UN General Assembly approved resolutions demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and an end to a war that has dragged on for 14 months. The United Kingdom has banned indefinitely the use of puberty blockers for minors who struggle with gender dysphoria. Britain put a temporary pause on prescribing the medications in May of this year after a report showed they present an unacceptable safety risk for children. Government officials say clinical trials will be held next year to establish clear evidence for the drug's effects on minors. An update to a news preview we brought you last week on EWTN News in Depth as a grand ceremony and fanfare unfolded last weekend at the Vatican. Pope Francis created 21 new cardinals during his 10th consistory last Saturday. The new cardinals hail from 16 countries, a reflection of the Holy Father's focus on a global church. Pope Francis, who was sporting a visible bruise after hitting his chin on his bedside table, told cardinals to follow the path of Jesus and resist what he called the seduction of power. Almost 80% of the cardinals eligible to vote in the next conclave have been appointed by Pope Francis. After Mass in St. Peter's Basilica, friends and family greeted the newly created cardinals to take photos and offer their congratulations. Among them, Cardinal Mykola Bichak, a leader of Australia's Ukrainian Catholic Church and the youngest cardinal at just 44 years old. Another young cardinal is the head of Toronto, Cardinal Francis Leo, the only delegate from North America. And Cardinal George Jacob Kouvikod, commonly referred to as the Holy Father's so-called travel agent because he coordinates all global papal trips. The Nobel Peace Prize has a new recipient. Japan's Nihon Hidankyo is a grassroots movement of Japanese atomic bomb survivors who have spent decades campaigning against nuclear weapons. Three survivors accepted the Peace Prize on behalf of the organization in Norway on Tuesday. One of them, Terumi Tanaka, gave the speech. Now 92 years old, he was only 13 when the U.S. dropped the bomb on Nagasaki in 1945. Though he did not suffer any serious injuries, he lost five family members. In his speech, Tanaka expressed concern. The use of nuclear weapons grows less taboo as global superpowers expand their arsenals. He asked those present to work together to ensure nuclear weapons do not destroy humanity. Our final story, understanding those who need some special care when we return.
They haven't been with their child here in 5 years to Mass, and this is the first opportunity that they were able to come back with their child. And so what a blessing that we're giving so many families.
Let the children come, welcoming a special needs population to worship. Designed for those who find regular church services too overwhelming, we'll tell you about the sensory Mass when we return.
After much loving thought, study, and planning, a special type of Mass is being offered at a church in Northern Virginia. What is called a sensory Mass provides a safe space for parishioners with sensory processing issues, mental illness, or disabilities to worship in an accepting environment. It is offered at only a handful of parishes around the country. EWTN News In Depth attended a sensory Mass last weekend. Here's reporter Roselle Regis.
Creating a safe and welcoming space where everyone feels accepted and can be themselves.
With the sensory Mass, she was able to sit through beautifully today.
This is what Nativity Catholic Church in Burke, Virginia strives to be with its sensory Mass. It's like regular Mass, but with a few changes.
Dimming the lighting, softer sounds, turning down the speaker system, less music and quieter times.
A sensory Mass helps reduce overstimulation and sensory overload. Many people benefit from this environment, including those with sensory processing challenges, autism, intellectual and developmental disabilities, and adults with Alzheimer's disease and dementia.
When I heard that 20% of the population struggles with that and would not be able to come to Mass, I said, I think we need to take a look at this. It got my attention. Because I really believe in opening wide the doors for those with developmental disabilities, and because they bring so many gifts to the church.
Monsignor Bob Selinsky is the pastor at Nativity. He tells us that the sensory Mass was a product of grassroots efforts.
It initiated by one of our parents who have children on the spectrum, and which led her to become an expert and a teacher in working with those who have sensory integration challenges.
That parishioner was Tracy Hewlin.
So I had noticed at church that we had a lot of families that were standing in the back, and they weren't really, they didn't have the availability to go into the training room because there were a lot of babies and crying, and some of the children needed a little bit more movement, so being in the pews was a little bit difficult.
With Monsignor Bob on board, Hewlin partnered up with the parish's family ministry coordinator and special religious development team. For 2 years, they went to work planning for the parish's first sensory Mass. Part of that included preparing a variety of regulation tools for people to use, such as noise cancellation headphones, fidget toys, and wobble stools. They even created a special missalette.
We have a adapted missalette, and inside it has a visual schedule of the Mass. And so they can check off the different parts of the Mass as they occur. And for somebody that needs that predictability of what's going to happen, and in the Mass we have a lot of loud parts and quiet parts.
Priests at Nativity were also part of the training. Monsignor Bob explains how he changes his homily for sensory Mass.
So whatever the message is, three sentences is ideal, repeat it three times, and then sit down, and then silence. And it can be a really powerful homily.
Prepare the way of the Lord. Live in hope.
After much hard work, Nativity Church celebrated its first once-a-month sensory Mass in August. Lorraine Sakara and her daughter Jill have been attending since.
It's wonderful. I am thrilled. And I am so thrilled to have Jill back in the pews receiving Eucharist.
Lorraine explains that Jill has autism spectrum disorder and is extremely sensitive to noises, that it would be very difficult for her to sit through regular Mass. So for many years, Jill did not go to church for Mass and only watched Masses online.
She would be overwhelmed with overwhelming visual stimulation by the crowds. The noise, things that don't bother a neurotypical person, would be really upsetting to her. And just as an idea of how difficult it was for her, she would be sitting in Mass and would sneak her pencil out and just would be digging in her nails until they bled.
Now Jill is able to sit through the entirety of sensory Mass. And if she needed a break, she can go to one of the sensory rooms available. Monsignor Bob says every time they have the sensory Mass, the congregation keeps growing. And he has met so many new families. The Nativity Parish community hopes its sensory Mass gains attention so that more sensory Masses will be available nationwide.
Well, it wouldn't be the Church of Jesus Christ if people were left out, because Jesus reached out to everyone. Hopefully, others will be able to respond to that need and would want to in their own diocese and in their own parishes.
Russell Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
If you are interested in the sensory Mass and the model that Nativity Catholic Church has developed, you can find online resources at nativityburke.org/sensory Mass. It might be a program your diocese wants to explore. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hedro. We hope to see you again next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life, including for the upcoming holiday, a special report from Austria about the origins of the Christmas carol, Silent Night. Until then, God bless.